ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today is a pretty special episode. I invite you to listen to the interview with Christopher Gimmer at our new Better Done Than Perfect podcast. If you enjoy this episode, that you might as well check out the show at userless.com/podcast. Well, let's give it a listen. Our awesome guest today is Christopher Gimmer, co-founder of Snappa, and we're going to talk about templates, onboarding videos, and much more. This show is brought to you by UserList, the best tool for sending onboarding emails and segmenting your SaaS users. To follow the best practices, download our free printable email planning worksheets at userlist.com/worksheets. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're so excited. Thanks so much for your time. Before we get started, could you tell us a bit more about your product, a little bit of your founder's story, and how long you've been running Snappa?
Yeah, so Snappa is essentially an online graphic design tool for non-designers. So our target audience is small business owners and marketers that need to create online graphics, but either don't have the budget to work with a graphic designer, or just, you know, for efficiency reasons, want to, you know, be able to create them themselves, you know, especially with in a world where everyone's posting on social media and images are disappearing in feeds within the day. You know, we want to make it really easy for people to be able to create graphics themselves. In terms of the founding story, my background was actually in finance and accounting. And eventually I met my co-founder, Mark, who was doing kind of development on the side, and eventually wanted to kind of become an entrepreneur. And I was really fascinated by kind of the tech industry and software in particular. So I won't bore you with the long story, but the short version is we kind of iterated on a few projects. And eventually I kind of got good at SEO and content marketing and realized that there was a need for, you know, graphic design tool that was more cater to marketers, because I found it a pain to design images for some of the blog posts and stuff that I was working on. So, you know, one thing led to another, and then we ended up launching Snappa in 2015 to kind of meet that need.
So let's recap before we dive in into actual user onboarding. What is the target audience? Is it just marketers, or is it wider? And what does your product do for them?
Yeah, so we actually did a survey a little while ago, and essentially what we found was about 50% of the people using Snappa classify themselves as either an entrepreneur, a small business owner, a solopreneur, that kind of thing. And then 25% would classify themselves as, you know, a marketer, a social media manager, that kind of stuff. So that pretty much makes up about 75% of the user base. And then we have this really long tail of a lot of random use cases. You know, we've seen churches and pastors, we've seen personal trainers, we've seen restaurants, we've seen just all kinds of things. But yeah, I would say the primary use case is kind of for the small business. There's actually a lot of, you know, social media agencies that they'll use Snappa to create graphics on behalf of their clients. So that's the predominant use case. And in terms of what they're doing, definitely the biggest use case is anything related to social media. So creating graphics for Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, creating YouTube thumbnails, channel art, and then content marketing is another one. So creating images for blogs, Facebook ads, display ads, infographics. So essentially, it's really meant for online graphics with like a marketing purpose for them, I would say.
What do you feel the biggest roadblocks are? Because I imagine the success in your app looks like actually creating a graphics, but what are the obstacles? Is it lack of imagination, lack of, I don't know, clip art, lack of stock photography, anything else?
Yeah, so when we first launched Snappa, the beta version didn't have any sort of templates. And we realized really quickly that for non-designers, as you can imagine, you know, creating a graphic from scratch is very difficult and presents quite a big roadblock. So early on, we kind of discovered that templates was really, you know, going to be a big part of Snappa and eliminating that big roadblock of, okay, what am I actually going to create? And then, you know, there's little things here and there, but really the biggest roadblock was, you know, what am I going to create? Like, you know, lack of imagination, like you said. So that was always like the biggest one from day one.
Tell us more about the templates. I imagine many founders find it applicable that, you know, templates are going to make us successful. But how do you even approach creation of such templates? How do you decide what's important? How do you produce them? Do you hire experts? Do you do it yourself? What did you do in particular with Snappa?
Yeah, so this is really evolved over time, actually. So when we first launched Snappa, we basically just hired, or we essentially contracted out, you know, freelancers and graphic designers, and didn't really give that much direction, and was just like, you know, create some templates for us. And they were okay, but, you know, not the best. And then the problem as well was, you know, a graphic designer might be really good at designing, but they might not necessarily know what makes a good YouTube thumbnail and what makes a good image for Facebook. So within the last year, we kind of really overhauled this process. So we recently hired someone to handle our social media page as well as some other stuff. And, you know, he's really good at understanding what makes a good YouTube thumbnail, what makes a good image for Facebook and Instagram and all that kind of stuff. And then we also hired a full-time in-house graphic designer. So essentially the way that we're approaching it now is, for the most part, our social media manager is essentially coming up with certain contexts and even kind of like the copy within the template and kind of the vision for it. And then working with the graphic designer to say, okay, here's kind of the vision for it. Here's the inspiration. Here's kind of, and then we'll even have a spreadsheet with what text to use and that kind of stuff. And then the graphic designer will actually go ahead and design that graphic. And we found that this has worked really, really well, because now we have, you know, two people that really understand what makes a good template. It's not just, you know, throwing random things together. And, you know, it's important to a certain extent to kind of keep up with the trends. So we'll, you know, we'll look at popular brands and popular accounts, see what kind of stuff they're posting, see what's popular right now, and then, you know, implementing some of those templates as well. And then the other thing that we found is really handy is that we'll actually track statistics of individual templates. So we can see, you know, how many people are clicking on a template, how many people are actually, you know, using that template and then downloading that graphic and saving that graphic. So we can determine which templates are actually resonating with the audience. And then we can also get a good idea of whether they're actually successful in repurposing and using these templates. Like, for example, if we see that a template has a ton of people clicking on it, but then no one's actually saving or downloading a graphic, that's kind of an indication to us that, you know, maybe that template is too complicated to repurpose, so that even though it looks nice, it might be difficult for the end user to actually modify and use within their designs. So that's kind of how our templating process has kind of evolved over the years.
How do you manage the library? Do you go like every 6 months and review the templates and remove the old ones? Or do you give access to the entire like 5 years worth of templates that you ever created and uploaded?
Yeah. So right now we do give you access to kind of everything, but we have kind of done somewhat of a cleanup in the past. So typically what we'll do is on a quarterly basis, we'll kind of go through and see how some of the templates are performing. Another thing that we've done, which has been really helpful, is we essentially have featured templates. So when you, for example, click on, you know, a Facebook post, the first four templates that you'll see will be featured templates. And what we try to do is we try to highlight the best performing templates so that, you know, we can kind of be assured that their first run experience is going to go well if they're choosing one of those featured templates that are kind of tried and tested and tried and whatnot. So on a quarterly basis, we'll update those featured templates based on, you know, what has been performing well. Some of the featured templates we've been using for a while just because, you know, they do really well and they resonate really well. But if we see a new template that we posted, you know, a couple months ago doing really well, then we might feature that template. And then similarly, kind of like I was mentioning before, if we see templates, you know, really aren't being clicked on, people seem to be having difficulty, you know, modifying or using them, then we might, depending on kind of how severe it is, we might just get rid of them altogether. Yeah.
From the product design perspective, how do you surface those templates and find that balance between presenting the blank canvas and giving these opportunities to start with a template without making it overwhelming, for example?
Yeah, so essentially the way it works is when you click on your size, so like let's say you're creating a Twitter post, we give you the option on that screen to create from scratch, or you can select one of the templates. So if someone really has an idea for, you know, a specific type of image they want to create, they can, you know, obviously go ahead and create from scratch and kind of bypass the templates that we're trying to present to them. And what a lot of people do is they can then, you know, obviously save some of their own custom designs and then, you know, repurpose those ones. So that could be pretty helpful too to the users.
You've already mentioned that you not only look at the original engagement with the templates, but also with the number of downloads, which is the sign of productivity with this specific template.
Yeah.
What are the other success metrics, you know, key parameters, properties that you try to identify and track that indicate user success? Are there any specific ones to your industry?
That's a good question. We're probably not as sophisticated as maybe we could be. So really the ones that we're looking at right now are clicks, saves, and downloads, and then the percentage basis. So if we see that, you know, one template, you know, 30% of the people that have clicked on it have actually saved or downloaded a graphic, you know, that's usually a pretty good sign. Whereas if only 5 to 10% of the people who've clicked or on a template have downloaded it, that's usually a sign that there's kind of an issue there. Either it's too difficult to repurpose, or, you know, it wasn't kind of what they originally anticipated. So those are the main ones. But one thing that we're also kind of looking at is which templates have led to upgrades within the product, because Snappa is a freemium tool. So that's another interesting thing that we're looking at as well. But some of it kind of depends on whether there's enough data for it, because we have quite a bit of templates. So, you know, in order to make those kinds of decisions, you definitely need a pretty big sample size to make any sort of like actual decisions around that kind of data.
Were there any exciting discoveries or insights on that along those lines?
I mean, like preliminary, we found that there is kind of a decent correlation between just the percentage of downloads and saves. So in terms of like actual engagement and whether that could potentially lead to upgrades as well. So hasn't been anything like super groundbreaking on that front, but more or less reiterating that focusing on and improving templates that lead to better engagement will probably lead to, you know, more upgrades as well.
It's really great that you mentioned the freemium conversion problem. Well, because it's not exactly a problem, it's like the cornerstone of the entire business economics for a freemium product. So what do you do to encourage the conversion into paid? Do you have like gating features, promotions, anything else that helps you in that direction?
Yeah, the biggest thing is essentially usage. So most of the features you can get on either the free or the paid plan, but then we cap out the free plan at 3 downloads per month. So essentially, if you're going to be using Snappa on a regular basis, then that kind of puts you into the paid tier. So the biggest thing for us is really encouraging usage of the product. So, you know, in terms of onboarding, like I said, the first thing is really making sure that they have that good first run experience and that they do, you know, save or download their first graphic so that they're going to want to come back for more. And then one of the ways that, you know, we try to facilitate that is through our email onboarding. So when someone signs up for Snappa, you know, they get a welcome email with, you know, a couple links. And then from there, depending on, you know, their usage of the app, we'll send them some more follow-up emails so that they can discover either certain features. And then we also help them with, you know, some ideas on what type of graphics they could be creating, ideas for, you know, social media posts and Instagram stories, because at the end of the day, we realize there's as you would expect, there's a very high correlation between users of the product and churn and how much value they're getting from it. So we try to help them understand, you know, what type of graphics that they can and should be creating, and give them some ideas for that. So even if, so it kind of, you know, the first step is helping them get value from the product. And then the second step is, you know, giving them more ideas for additional graphics that they could be creating that maybe they haven't even thought of.
It feels like founders fall into two camps. So camp number one basically sends and nags the user until they start doing something, which we don't feel is productive. And you obviously fall into the second camp, which means the more the person uses the app, the more you can start sending them and the more helpful you can be with the tips and everything else, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Have you been that wise from like day one, or have there been any discoveries along the way?
Our email onboarding has changed a little bit, but in kind of our most recent iteration, it just kind of dawned on me that not only do, you know, does someone need to understand how to use the actual product, but they kind of also need to understand, you know, why Snappa is beneficial and why they should be even creating these types of graphics in the first place. And so that's when, you know, we try to take both of those things into consideration in the onboarding flow. Whereas in the beginning, it was literally just like, hey, use this feature, watch this video, use this feature, watch this video. And now we try to mix in a bit more of, here are some ideas for creating social media posts. Here are some ideas when thinking about Instagram stories. And so reality, that type of content will be helpful even if you're not even using Snappa.
Another really interesting thing that you're doing is the customization of the onboarding experience. And I'd love you to share that, how you track people from their landing page straight into the app. And not too many products out there go as far. Was it complex to set up? How does it work and how productive that is?
Yeah, so one of the things with Snappa is that there's a lot of use cases. So, and what we discovered is that there's a lot of search volume for these various use cases. So for example, we have landing pages that are set up to target keywords like Facebook cover maker, Twitter header maker, YouTube thumbnail maker. And so if someone searches in Google for YouTube thumbnail maker, and then they land on our landing pages or our landing page, obviously they are trying to create a YouTube thumbnail. So originally, we basically had one kind of onboarding tutorial video that we were serving across like all of our signup pages. And then we realized that's probably not a good idea, because if someone lands on the YouTube thumbnail maker, it's clear that they're creating they're wanting to create a YouTube thumbnail. So what we did was essentially we created different onboarding tutorial videos for those specific use cases. So if someone signs up from the YouTube thumbnail page, the onboarding video that they're going to see is how to, you know, create a YouTube thumbnail by repurposing one of our templates. And similarly, if they sign up for Facebook cover maker, the onboarding video is going to, you know, show them how to create a Facebook cover. And once we did that, we did notice a slight uptick in terms of the percentage of people that signed up and then actually created a graphic and subsequently converted to paid as well.
How do you approach the creation of those onboarding videos? Because I know a lot of people, myself included, they're hugely intimidated. There is a range of things you can do. You can do like a talking head of yourself. You can do screen share, a screen recording. You can go as far as like, I don't know, animating like UI components in a very fancy way, like, or do little animated people, you know, doing something. What's your approach? How do you do those?
Yeah, so we're doing screen shares in the early days of Snappa too. We actually, in that onboarding video, we were kind of creating stuff from scratch, and it kind of, I think, went on a bit longer than necessary. And so coming back to just how important the templates are, we kind of changed our approach. And so now our onboarding videos, essentially what we do is we're doing a screen share of basically taking an existing template and then repurposing that for a different use case. And then each of those videos, we try to make them as concise as possible. So typically they're about a minute long, because what we realized, as well as people have short attention spans nowadays, and a lot of people end up skipping things. So we found that at least for that first run experience, we wanted to make it super quick, super concise, and show just how easy and fast it is to simply select a template and then be able to, you know, edit the text, swap out a different background image, and literally within a minute, they can have a completely custom graphic suited to their needs. So that's kind of essentially how we've evolved the onboarding videos.
Tell us a bit more about your technical implementation for, you know, propagating that parameter from the landing page towards inside the product. Is it really hard to implement, or is it accessible to mere mortals?
Well, it's accessible to developers. I'm actually not one of the programmers behind the product, but essentially what we're doing is we're cooking. So when someone lands on that landing page, it essentially we cookie that user, and then once they actually sign up for the product, essentially we have, you know, a line of code that reads what landing page they've come from, and then it will serve the corresponding, you know, onboarding video.
Tell us a bit more about your first run experience. And I know you've done a successful experiment that you used later on about removing the confirmation emails. So how do you approach this smooth, frictionless onboarding experience? And what did you do about the emails?
Yeah, so originally we were requiring email confirmations as part of the sign-up process. And I have to give a hat tip to Wes Bush from the Product Led Institute. And we were actually in Thailand at the time, and he was like, you have to get rid of the email confirmations. This is a lot of friction. And so sure enough, we ran an experiment where we removed the email confirmation so that people can get access to the app right away. And if I remember correctly, it was something like when he did mention that, so I'd kind of gone in my analytics and realized there was, in fact, I think it was like a 20 or 25% drop off from people that, you know, clicked on sign up, but then didn't actually go through the email confirmation step. And so I always kind of theorize that, well, they're probably not that interested in the product anyways. And I didn't think that it would make that big of a difference when actually measuring like conversion rate from sign up to paid. And shockingly, when we did remove that step, you know, sure enough, we got like a 20 to 30% lift from the sign up, because there was no longer that extra step of email confirmation. But more surprisingly, the conversion rate from people entering the app to paid didn't really change that much. So we got almost like a 20% lift from free to paid just from removing that email confirmation step, which blew me away, quite frankly.
That, and also removing the credit card upfront, is one of the most powerful funnel modifiers that everybody can introduce, basically, for some dramatic results. Now, I imagine you never really had credit card upfront, right? Since your frictionless freemium product.
Yeah, that's correct. It's freemium. So essentially, once they get into the app, they have pretty much almost all the features available for free. And then if they exceed the download limits or click on, you know, a couple of the premium features, then they'll need to upgrade at that point.
How has your vision of the ideal onboarding evolved over years? What would you recommend to founders who are just starting to improve their onboarding experience these days compared to what you knew back then?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I would say, at least based on my experience, I think removing as much friction as possible is usually a good idea. There are obviously some caveats there, because if you have an app where maybe customer support is more time intensive, or maybe you have like crazy hosting costs, so you don't just want like a huge flood of people coming into the app. But if you're an app like ours, where the customer support is pretty limited. We don't have massive hosting bills, so each incremental user doesn't really cost us that much more money, and you can support more people into the funnel. I would typically lean on the side of less friction in terms of the signup process. The other interesting thing is, this is probably up for debate, but when I think about some of the products that I use, like Slack being a good example, you know, I don't remember there being this crazy onboarding flow with like 50 steps and tool tips and all this kind of stuff. The product itself is just very intuitive. Now, obviously, there are some onboarding steps. So I think, you know, one of the things that I think about is just how can you make the product itself very intuitive so that you don't have to introduce crazy onboarding tutorials and tool tips and all of these kind of complex workflows. Obviously, you need to add something, whether it's a video, whether it's, you know, a quick animation thing. One of the things I really like is checklists. That hasn't really worked for my product, but let's say if you're like an email marketing tool, you know, maybe one of the steps is like add the tracking pixel. The next step could be like set up your first onboarding campaign. So that kind of stuff. And I guess what is kind of your evolution with UserList? I'd be curious to hear that actually.
We have not arrived at the point of introducing a checklist, but yes, there are products out there, including ours, that don't have a very trivial onboarding. So we have really shortened the number of steps in the quick start guide and everything. So I guess our primary strategy is preparing some amazing docs firsthand. So it's like onboarding is the very tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. And we do have some email automation in place and everything. But there is so much to do, basically, that the only way to encourage it is to just provide some inspiration and make sure you're available at all stages as people. So we do have a lot of in-person support and so on. It's such a different dynamics compared to your product, I imagine.
Yeah, for sure. I would imagine UserList has way more steps and things that are needed to be done. But I think what it comes down to is you have to understand that when someone signs up for a product, they're probably not going to spend like 4 straight hours doing every single solitary thing in that app. And so I'm guilty of this too, where it's like you want to send them like every single instruction and you want to get them up and running right away. So, you know, my thinking has kind of evolved over the years where like, just give them a small taste, show them what's possible, show them how easy it is to use your product, and then slowly drip things over time, whether it's through email onboarding, whether it's through having amazing documentation so that they can look for it themselves, and, you know, and just making sure that the product is as intuitive as possible so that theoretically, if you didn't send them any sort of helpful tips, they would still be able to figure it out on their own.
Absolutely. This very much correlates with what previous guests also said on this show, such as Samuel Hulick, who as a consultant has worked with multiple businesses. And he says that, no, tooltips and tours, they don't work. It's always best to invest into self-serve onboarding as much to make it as much autonomous as possible of an experience. So good to see that your years of experience as a SaaS founder brought you to the same takeaways as onboarding consultants teach us.
That's great.
If you were to start from scratch with a different product, what would you do differently? What mistakes have you made and what mistakes other people should avoid?
The only thing that, if I can go back in time with Snappa, is hindsight's 2020, but essentially the way that we coded up the first version and even the second version of the app, it would be very difficult for us to do any sort of A/B testing of onboarding flows. So, you know, anytime we make a change, essentially what we're doing is we're measuring, okay, here's the conversion rate for the 2 weeks before the change, and then here's the conversion rate for the 2 weeks after change. But as you know, there could be a variety of factors that affect the conversion rate, and it might not necessarily be that specific change that was made. So if I can go back, or if I start a new product, I would love to have a way to run A/B tests for certain changes within the app so that we can really understand conversion rates between like the actual specific changes that we made to the onboarding. But apart from that, kind of like we talked about throughout this whole discussion, if I were to start a new app, I would try to, you know, remove as much friction from the onboarding as possible, you know, make sure that the app is extremely intuitive, and then create an onboarding flow that, you know, gives them enough upfront, but not to the point where it's overwhelming.
Thanks so much for sharing those tips. As we're wrapping up today's episode, where can people find you personally and your product online?
So they can find me on Twitter at cgimmer. And if they want to check out Snappa, they can go to snappa.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your wisdom today. It's been very helpful, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week.
Thanks a lot for having me. It was fun.
Thanks for listening. If you found the episode useful, please spread the word about this new show on Twitter, mentioning UserList, or leave us a review on iTunes.